This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Anger boiling in the Muslim world over a new act of desecration against the Holy Quran in Sweden. Setbacks for the UK ruling Conservative Party as it loses more seats in new by-elections. And Ukraine has dismissed the country's ambassador to the UK days after the envoy publicly criticized President Volodymyr Zelensky. Welcome everybody. Iranians from all walks of life have held demonstrations across the country to protest sacrilege of the Holy Quran in Sweden. The protesters poured into the streets of different Iranian cities after Friday prayers. They voiced support for Islamic sanctities. They also condemned Swedish police for granting permission to a new act of desecration against the Quran. Similar rallies were held in the capital cities of Pakistan and Lebanon as well. Meanwhile, the renowned Egyptian university Al-Azhar has called for boycotting Swedish products to protest the desecration of the Holy Quran. Several Muslim states, including Iran, have summoned Swedish envoys as well. On Thursday, Iraq ordered the Swedish ambassador to leave its soil and recalled Iraqi envoy. The same day, Iraqi protesters stormed the Swedish embassy to show their anger at the desecration of the Holy Quran. Well, Iranians have now gathered outside the Swedish embassy in the Iranian capital, Tehran, also in continuation of the condemnation of the desecration of the Holy Quran in Stockholm. We also were covering for you today millions of Iranians taking to the streets across the country following Friday prayers to voice their strong condemnation of the recent desecration of the Holy Quran. That's the second such incident in less than a month, and the demonstrations and protests continue as Iranians have gathered outside the Swedish embassy in Tehran, condemning the desecration of the Holy Quran in the Swedish capital, Stockholm. The mass rallies were held in major Iranian cities on Friday, after the Friday prayers, that is after a day, that is after a Swedish-based Iraqi refugee once again desecrated the Muslim holy book during a demonstration outside the Iraqi embassy in Stockholm amid strict protection provided by the Swedish police. The appalling act opened the floodgates of protest across the world's Muslim community, with the Iranian Foreign Ministry summoning the Swedish ambassador to Tehran and conveying the Islamic Republic's vehement condemnation of the heinous act. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the desecration of the Holy Quran as well as the course of condemnation from across the Muslim world over the insult. Let's listen to what our guests had to say about that.
Joining us for more on that is Saad al-Mutallabi, a former political advisor to the Iraqi government from the capital, Iraqi capital, Baghdad. And we also have Rina Rabai, a human rights activist from Beirut. So, Mr. Mutallabi, if I could start with you, what's your opinion on all this? Iraq has taken a major step by expelling the Swedish ambassador. And from its soil, the coordination framework, the coalition of political parties with the largest parliamentary majority said it was very encouraged by the move. We've also heard very powerful statements from the Hashd al-Sha'bi as well as Sunni organizations as well.
Yes, thank you very much. There is a consensus here in Iraq that the action of the justice system in Sweden by allowing the desecration of the Quran al-Karim for the third time cannot be ignored. Therefore, the foreign minister ordered the Iraqi charged affair to leave Stockholm for consultation here in Baghdad and asked the Swedish ambassador to leave. And yesterday I heard that she left Baghdad en route to Erbil, to Kurdistan. I don't know if she left Kurdistan or not, but she was last night in Kurdistan in Erbil. And all other government or state organizations in Iraq, the justice system, the parliamentarian system, the armed forces, the political parties, they've all aired their concern and their utmost anger at the Swedish government allowing the desecration of the Quran for the third time. They added to the insult in burning the Iraqi flag, which, as you know, the Iraqi flag has the word Allahu Akbar on it. So that's another insult to the sovereignty of the state of Iraq, and again to an insult to Islam. Allowing that in their country comes far away from the issues of freedom of speech. This is an attack on people's religions, attack on people's beliefs and their faith, and that is not allowed. That should not happen. All religions are respected. All religions should be allowed to practice their faith in peaceful coexistence without any insult directed to any of the world religions, where people can exercise their right of religion, right of faith, and a prayer at a complete safety and peacefully, and should not be subjected to any type of insult from any state-sponsored neo-Nazi, neo-nationalism that is taking place in Europe nowadays.
Okay, let me switch over to Rina Rabai, a human rights activist from Beirut. Now, Rina, where is the human rights of some around 2 billion Muslims when their most sacred book, the Holy Quran, is being burnt on a number of occasions?
Greetings to you. In the name of freedom of expression, the Swedish authorities claims that it allows profanation of the Holy Quran. And here I want to stress upon the word authorities, not the Swedish government only, but all the authorities, even the legislative authorities. If the Swedish laws does not criminalize such profane acts, the legislative authorities are also involved. If prosecutors do not prosecute such acts, then even the Swedish judiciary is involved. The Swedish authorities all know that this matter, profanating the Quran, does not fall within the framework of freedom of expression and definitely not human rights. And it does not need to be convinced of the opposite. The Swedish authorities have become an icon of discrimination, of profanity, disrespect, and intolerance. The Swedish authorities have proven that they do not understand or implement freedom of expression. So we, based on that, we strongly condemn Sweden's deliberate sponsorship of aggression and hate speech against Islam. What should happen is that only Sweden should be directed exactly. It should be economically and diplomatically boycotted. That's what should happen, and we definitely agree to what the General Secretary of Hezbollah said.
Okay, let me thank our guests. I'm afraid we have run out of time for their contribution. Saada Mutallabi is a former political advisor to the Iraqi government, joining us live from the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Mr. Mutallabi, thank you very much indeed. And also Rina Rabai, a human rights activist from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Ms. Rabai, thank you for your thoughts and contribution. That brings an end to another edition of the News Review.
Britain's ruling party has lost two parliamentary seats in Thursday's by-elections, regarded as a litmus test for the premiership of Rishi Sunak. Conservatives lost to the Liberal Democrats in St. and Frome, southwest England. Tories also lost their majority in the northern constituency of Selby and Anstey, where the opposition Labour won the seat. But the ruling party managed to retain its seat in a West London constituency, was left empty after former Prime Minister Boris Johnson resigned as a Member of Parliament in June. The results of the three by-elections were announced as incumbent Sunak is facing division within his party. The Tories are facing growing public discontent over a series of scandals as well as high inflation. The United Nations has criticized controversial British legislation purportedly aimed at deterring thousands of refugees from landing on the country's shore, and warned that it will have profound consequences for people in need of international protection. The bill would outlaw asylum claims by all arrivals via the Channel and also other so-called illegal routes. It would deport the refugees either to their country of origin or a third nation, such as Rwanda.
The United Nations has lashed out to the UK for its controversial immigration legislation, warning it could have profound consequences for the people in need of international protection. The UN refugee and human rights chief Volker Turk condemned the passage of the bill as a breach of international law and warned it would expose refugees to grave risks. He said the so-called illegal migration bill, which has been passed by the Parliament and now awaits the formality of the royal assent from King Charles III, is, quote, at variance with the country's obligations under international human rights and refugee law and will have profound consequences for the people in need of international protection. Turk also added that the bill will set a, quote, worrying precedent for dismantling asylum-related obligations that other countries, including in Europe, may be tempted to follow. The bill would outlaw asylum claims by all arrivals via the Channel and other illegal routes and deport them either to their country of origin or a third nation such as Rwanda. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Philippe Grandi also condemned the passage of the legislation as a breach of international law. This new legislation significantly erodes the legal framework that has protected so many.
But the problem with the government's bill from international law perspective is that it plans to abolish the right, and it's a very important right, of asylum seekers to apply in any country where they end up for asylum.
The plan to deport asylum seekers has been criticized by some opposition politicians, lawyers and civil rights groups as inhumane, cruel and ineffective. The Scottish Refugee Council, a charity that provides advice and services to refugees in the UK, said in a tweet that it's devastating to know the UK's illegal migration bill is now set to become law. Enver Solomon, the chief executive of the Refugee Council, has also criticised the law, saying the overall bill remains unworkable and will lead to human misery and huge cost to the taxpayer.
And so it's got no plan. It's got a gimmick, which is the Rwanda scheme, a gimmick, which has already cost the taxpayer £140 million and nobody's removed.
Prime Minister Sunak has insisted the Rwanda plan would have an important deterrent effect by showing that no one who arrives illegally in the UK will be allowed to stay. Britain struck an initial £140 million deal with the East African country last year. The first Rwanda deportation flight was blocked a year ago in a last-minute ruling by the European Court of Human Rights.
The Conservative government's flagship legislation will prevent most people from claiming asylum in the UK. The legislation is central to the Prime Minister's pledge to stop small boats crossing the English Channel. The government claims they will prevent people from claiming asylum in the UK if they arrive through unauthorised means. Deportation flights to Rwanda are unlikely to start until next year at the earliest and will still hinge on a ruling by the Supreme Court on their legality this year.
The deficiencies in the asylum system in Rwanda are such that there are substantial grounds for believing that there is a real risk that persons sent to Rwanda will be returned to their home countries where they face persecution or other inhumane treatment when in fact they have a good claim for asylum. In that sense, Rwanda is not a safe third country.
Britain signed an initial £140 million deal with Rwanda last year. The planned Rwanda deportation flight was blocked a year ago in a last-minute ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. Last year, a record 5,755 people came to Britain in small boats across the Channel, mainly from France. More than 12,000 have arrived this year, a rate similar to 2022. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who has vowed to stop the boats, has insisted the Rwanda plan would have an important deterrent effect by showing that no one who arrives illegally in the UK will be allowed to stay. Some analysts believe the Tories' insistence on the bill is partly due to the Conservative government's poor ratings in the polls. The governing Conservative Party has plummeted in the polls in recent years. As things stand, it's very unlikely they would win the next general election.
What can you ask me about? And it's a mess. You know, typical of a Tory government. Sorry, I got nothing good to say about them.
I think we need a change, but there's not really anybody that's suitable, I don't think, because they're all on the same ilk, all think the same. So, but we do need a change.
The Home Office Minister said the number of small boat arrivals had overwhelmed the UK's asylum system and was costing taxpayers £6 million a day to provide accommodation.
The Ukrainian president has dismissed the country's ambassador to the UK days after the envoy publicly criticized him. A presidential order said Vadim Pristaiko has also been removed as Ukraine's representative to the International Maritime Organization. The order did not detail the reason for Pristaiko's removal or the person replacing him. In an interview last week, Pristaiko said President Volodymyr Zelensky's remarks about the UK defense secretary were unhealthy. Pristaiko said there was some sarcasm in Zelensky's comment that he would wake up each morning and thank the UK defense secretary. This after Wallace said Ukraine's allies wanted to see gratitude and that the UK was not Amazon when it comes to weapons delivery. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Canada has already recorded its worst year in terms of scorched forest land area. Reports say almost 600 wildfires are out of control in Canada. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the number of wildfires in Canada classified as out of control is approaching 600, according to a national monitor. The country is experiencing its worst wildfire season in decades. According to the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Centre, CIFFC, there were over 900 active wildfires in the country, with 599 of them labelled out of control. Another 104 were being held by firefighters, while 204 were considered under control. British Columbia is the worst affected province, accounting for a third of active fires, according to CIFFC statistics. The blazes have devastated 10.7 million hectares nationwide during this fire season, with over 4,200 outbreaks reported this year. The area is the largest since the monitor started compiling statistics in the 1980s. The previous record was set in 1995, when over 7 million hectares burned out in Canada. The situation has been worsening since mid-May, when the national preparedness level was raised to its highest possible point for the first time in 2023. Last year, Ottawa avoided any similar mobilization of forces to deal with forest fires. Earlier this month, smoke from Canada traveled south and blanketed parts of the U.S. in a thick haze. New York was listed as the city with the worst air pollution in the world, as fumes covered the East Coast. New York City has resumed its place atop a list of the world's most polluted cities, beating out runners-up in Vietnam and India with an unhealthy rating of 184, IQ Air reported recently. Hundreds of massive wildfires raging across several Canadian provinces have burned for nearly a week, filling the air across the eastern U.S. with a choking orange-brown haze composed of hazardous particulate matter. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the devastating blaze as the worst wildfire season they have ever had right across the country. More than 9.4 million acres have burnt, amounting to more than 15 times the 10-year average, according to the country's Minister of Emergency Preparedness, while over 125,000 people have been forced to evacuate. Trailing New York on the most polluted cities list are Hanoi and Detroit. According to the New York Times, wildfires in Western Canada are expected to create smoky conditions in the United States this week. Parts of the U.S. had unhealthy air in June from wildfires in other parts of Canada. Smoke from wildfires in Western Canada drifted across the Midwest and the Northeast of the United States, blotting out blue sky and sun and blanketing dozens of cities with unhealthy air that triggered warnings to limit the time spent outdoors. It was the second time in less than a month that the borderless impact of climate change could be felt with a breath. In June, heavy smoke from Quebec wafted into the East Coast and blew from New York City, past Washington, as far west as Minnesota. This week, as nearly 900 wildfires burnt across Canada, the smoke came from fires in the western part of the country, billowing into its southern neighbor across a wide trail. By 7 p.m. Eastern Time, nearly 70 million people in 32 states and the District of Columbia were affected by the shifting, migrating smoke, according to estimates, based on information from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and LandScan, a population database. Unfortunately, the wildfire smoke will begin to make a return to the region to start the new week, according to the National Weather Service in the Philadelphia area. Air quality alerts ranging from moderate to very unhealthy were issued by government agencies from Montana to the Dakotas and parts of other states, including Nebraska, Alabama, Tennessee, Ohio, North Carolina, and along the Northeast. Residents were advised to take precautions from limiting outdoor activities to covering up with masks. In Chicago, where the air quality deteriorated through the weekend, Mayor Brandon Johnson warned children, older residents, and those with heart or lung disease to limit outdoor activity. He said, "We are actually aware that the recent weather events prominently impacting our city this summer are the direct result of the climate crisis." Air quality advisories were also in effect across parts of Massachusetts. Governor Katie Hochul of New York issued air quality health advisories. The air quality in parts of upstate New York was expected to reach unhealthy levels for all residents, while conditions in Lower Hudson Valley, New York City, and Long Island were expected to be unhealthy only for sensitive groups. Air quality across the region was worsening, with parts of the city and state clocking more than 100 on the air quality index. Hochul said in a statement, "New Yorkers should once again prepare for smoke from the wildfires in Western Canada to impact our state's air quality this week," adding that officials were activating emergency notifications on roads and public transit systems and making sure that masks were available for distribution in counties across the state. The air quality index in Rochester started at 141 early on Monday, while Buffalo's was at 116, but those readings were improving in both cities by late afternoon. New York City officials said that conditions which are considered unhealthy for sensitive groups could persist for the initial part of the week.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ يُوهُ بِلِيهِ اسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Respected scholars and elders and brothers and sisters, عظم الله أجورنا وأجوركم بمصابنا بالحسين عليه السلام. The title of the series is Karbala, the Enlightened Journey. Now that is a generic title, but inshallah you'll see in the course of the nights, those of you who will be with us, that these words were chosen with precision, meaning that there's something we're going to describe about Karbala and enlightenment. Now, in order to introduce the topic, I want to take us to the years leading up to the tragedy of Ashura. And we want to evaluate what's happening in the Muslim Ummah at that time. From some perspectives, if we were to look at history, things were actually going pretty well from some criteria. You know, when you want to evaluate something, what's really important is you have to see what criteria are you using to evaluate. Because depending on that, your results are going to differ. So from some criteria, things were going pretty well. For example, if you were to take a poll and statistics and you say the number of those who had memorized the Quran in the Muslim Ummah from the time of our Prophet to the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you'd see that the graph is increasing. People were memorizing the Quran. People were gaining more familiarity with the teachings of the Quran, at least on an outer level. There were people who were living beyond the Prophet's time, meaning that they lived past the Prophet, people who were the writers of the wahi of the Quran, meaning that they could tell stories about how different ayat were revealed at different times. There was people who were living at that time who could tell the stories of what happened in Badr and Uhud and Khandaq and all these Ahzab, all these great battles. They could tell these stories. You could go and meet these living legends. People like Ammar, people like Salman, at least for some time, they were alive. From some perspective, things were going well. The mosques might have been full at that time. The Quran was being read. There were even people who were there who, let's say people didn't understand the position of the Ahlul Bayt being the divine representatives, at least they could go and say that these are the family of the Prophet. And they could go and they could see them, they could interact with them. Right? Things were, from some perspectives, they were looking pretty good. But you and I know that at the same time that these apparent manifestations of Islam, maybe they were going in a good direction, at the same time there was a deep sickness that was growing in the Muslim Ummah at that time. And it's this sickness that I want to kind of dig into. I want to try to see if we can come up, use a word to describe this sickness. But in order to do that, I would like to first take us to the Quran, where Allah Ta'ala, in four verses of the Quran, He mentions a particular term, which inshallah we're going to be using throughout the course of these lectures. What is this term? Let me mention a couple of these ayat. The first one is Surah Al-Ahzab. Allah Ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وقرنا في بيوتكن ولا تبرجن تبرج الجاهلية الأولى. This command is for the wives of the Prophet, specifically, where Allah Ta'ala tells them that you stay in your homes. Right? This was a special command for the wives of the Prophet. And then He gives a command of another command which applies to the wives of the Prophet first and foremost, but then also it's a general command, which is what? Do not do tabarruj. Tabarruj comes from the word buruj, like towers. Right? You know how they're very apparent. You can see them from far away. Allah says that don't do things so that you are visible like towers. Now then He describes those particular activities that would make a lady, a female, visible by saying that that is the type of activity that belongs to al-jahiliyatil ula. Jahiliya, of course, means the era or the mannerisms of ignorance, the lifestyle of ignorance. So that's ayah number one. Ayah number two, Allah Ta'ala is describing in Surah Ali Imran what happened in the Battle of Uhud. Now you know from Islamic history that Battle of Uhud was a difficult battle for the Muslims. Because at one point, you know, they were in the lead and then things went completely the other way. And they ended up losing a lot of casualties. Even some thought that our Prophet, our beloved Prophet, had been killed. And there was a lot of grief that took place after this battle. So what happened? Allah Ta'ala describes the people at that time, and he says that there was a group of amongst them, قَدْ أَهَمَّتْهُمْ أَنفُسُهُمْ يَظُنُّونَ بِاللَّهِ ظَنَّ الْجَاهِلِيَةِ. There was people who were thinking and they were suspecting and thinking and they were bringing back the beliefs of the era of ignorance, the Jahiliyyah. Okay, what's the story behind that? It's very interesting. There were some people who had a very black and white understanding of the way this world works. They used to think that, look it, if you just, all you got to do if you want to make it in this world is you got to find the right God to connect to. Right? So let's say, for example, the stone god is your good luck god. Then if you go to that stone god, then you're going to find success in everything that you do. You'll win all your battles. You'll get all your trade the way you want it. And you'll even get married on top of that. Everything's going to be good for you. Okay? But if it doesn't work, then you go to the wood god. Maybe that's going to work for you. So they used to think that depending on how you chose your god, you just connected to the right, you know, sort of deity, then success is guaranteed for you. So they were thinking that, okay, we know that our prophet is the prophet. We know Islam is the religion. So then, well, of course we're going to be victorious. Everything we do, we're going to find success in. What was wrong here? The thing that was wrong in their thinking is that now when they started to see that failure, they started to think that, hey, maybe we didn't connect to the right deity. Right? Maybe this whole approach of trusting solely in Allah and letting Him determine the results is not the right approach to take. So Allah reveals a verse and He corrects their thinking. Don't go back to that way of thinking. Now you're supposed to be elevated in your thinking. You have one source, one mudabbir, one entity that manages your affairs, one entity in which you trust, one who is in charge. But you should know that one who is in charge acts according to wisdom and according to a certain system. At times you may see success. At times you might see apparent failure. But as long as you're doing your duty, you are still successful. So Allah corrects their thinking. And there's other ayat as well that I'm not going to mention right now. But what I do want to say is that in the Quran, at times Allah warns people that now that you have Islam, don't go back to Jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah, the era of ignorance, as you can see from these examples, it can apply to the way we do things, our actions. It can apply to the way that we perceive things, our beliefs. And in other examples, it can be in the way that we construct our ethical system, the way we see our values. All of them can fall under Jahiliyyah. Now, it's very interesting, brothers and sisters. You know, there were people who would read these ayat of the Quran and they would memorize them and they would think about them and reflect upon them, and sometimes they would have a question. So in this case, I'm sure there's a question that came to many of your mind, which was the following, that why is it that Allah describes the Jahiliyyah as being al-Jahiliyyah al-Ula? Why does He describe it as being the first Jahiliyyah? What does that mean? So this question was posed of the Ahlul Bayt to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And in riwayat, in ahadith, in narrations, we're told in a few of them, they say that the same way that there was a time of ignorance, there was a period and a lifestyle of ignorance, the same way that there will come again a period of ignorance as well. And in one tradition, we're told that our prophet says that that second period of ignorance will be worse than the first period of ignorance.
Oh, Hussein, you live forever in our hearts and in our minds. I swear to Allah and to my last breath, I will remember to Allah whenever I face troubles in my life. I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In Britain, a new study has indicated that up to 3 million British people behind on their bills have had mental health problems. The new study has suggested that people with recent mental health issues are 3 times more likely to be behind on at least one key bill. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Up to 3 million people in the United Kingdom who are behind with at least one bill have experienced a mental health problem in the last 2 years, according to new research. YouGov polling for the Money and Mental Health Policy Institute charity found that 12% of all people were behind on at least one payment, such as energy, rent or credit cards, of whom half, or about 3 million, had a mental health problem. In all, people who have had mental health problems in the past 2 years are 3 times more likely to be behind on at least one significant bill, the report found, with 60% saying they felt unable to cope due to rising costs. Yet, only 9% have received money or debt advice since the start of the cost of living crisis. The charity Money and Mental Health Policy Institute calculates that the government could save more than £140 million a year and double recovery rates for people with depression and debt by joining up mental health and money support. It calls on the government and the National Health Service England to provide practical financial advice alongside National Health Service talking therapies. This would double recovery rates for people struggling with debt and depression, help an extra 27,000 people recover from mental health problems each year, and reduce waiting times for the mental health services. The authors of the new report calculate that these changes would save £39 million by reducing demand for health and social care services and generate £105 million in wider economic benefits and boost to workplace productivity, resulting in more people recovering from mental health problems. Martin Lewis, the chair and founder of the Money and Mental Health Policy Institute, said, "The cost of living crisis shows no sign of abating, and even if it does, the fallout will last for years. Financial problems and mental health issues are locked together. It's about time that treatments were linked too." For many years, therapists, mental health nurses, and social workers have told us they often spend substantial, valuable clinical time helping people with their finances. It makes more sense to leave debt help professionals to do that and take some pressure off the National Health Service, letting clinicians focus on helping people get better. Rachel, a 46-year-old from Cardiff in Wales, has had depression most of her life. But when she tried to come off her medication, she went into a downward spiral of spending and gambling and ran up debts of about £15,000. It's mad because the more debt you get in, the more the credit card companies will give you, she said. At one point, I had about 10 different credit cards. She says at no point did any health professional ask her how she was coping financially, and she felt unable to raise it herself. Suzanne Hoddy, a 37-year-old nurse from Leicester, says no one considered whether she could handle her finances on discharge from a mental health setting in 2017. Never at any point did anyone ask me, who's actually managing the house, all the bills? Is that going to be a potential issue when she gets home? She said. There was no thought of that. Had they done so earlier, Suzanne Hoddy might have avoided a court summons for failing to pay her council tax bill while an inpatient. Linking mental health and money services might mean an extra 5 minutes that you've had to spend with that person. But for that person's recovery, it's made a massive difference, she says. Dr. Subodh Dave, Dean of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, says psychiatrists were intensely aware of the significant impact of the cost of living crisis on patients' mental health. Dr. Subodh Dave said, debt may have disastrous consequences for individuals and their families. Clinicians can play their part by inquiring about their patients' financial situation and how this might be affecting their mental health status. Collaboration is needed from a range of other bodies, including financial advice services and social care organisations. A government spokesperson said, we're investing £2.3 billion of extra funding a year by March of 2024 to expand and transform mental health services in England to treat an additional 2 million patients. We've also helped nearly 2 million people out of absolute poverty since 2010 and provided a £94 billion support package worth about £3,300 per household to help those most in need. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Employee assistance programs are usually pretty dull affairs. For a few decades now, employers have paid employee assistance program providers to run phone lines their employees can call if they need support with personal problems. The idea is to provide some short-term support, a handful of counselling sessions, say, to help staff deal with mild problems before they get worse. But this year, employee assistance programs have found themselves facing a swelling wave of complex mental health problems brought to them by people with nowhere else to turn. We were never designed to be a crisis line, says Bertrand Stern-Gillett, who runs Health Assured, the biggest employee assistance program provider in the United Kingdom, with more than 80,000 clients. But he says high-risk calls have now become a daily occurrence, ranging from child or adult safeguarding concerns to someone who might have taken a significant amount of pills, or they might be standing on a bridge. The company is hiring more staff and managers to try to deal with the rising complexity and emotional intensity of the work. Andrew Kinder, head of mental health services at Optima Health, another employee assistance program, ran an online seminar about bereavement for the employees of one client. He expected about 40 attendees, but 1,200 people logged on. People were actually sharing quite a lot of experiences about what they've gone through, he says. Antidepressant usage is also on the rise. In 2021-2022, 8.3 million patients received at least one prescription item for antidepressant drugs in England, according to the data, 22% more than in 2015-2016. But what's going on? On the positive side, people have become more comfortable discussing their mental health status and asking for help. That's an improvement on the past when we had this undercurrent of need that wasn't even being talked about, says Vicky Nash, head of policy at mental health charity Mind. But it's clear that's not the whole story. The loneliness, the worry, grief and financial problems caused by COVID-19 and associated lockdowns appear to have damaged the mental health of people all over the world.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Who is Imam Hussein? Why did he launch an uprising? The essence of imamate is contradictory to the essence of the kingdom. These two are contradictory. Imamate is moral and spiritual leadership and compassionate and belief-related bonds with the people, whereas a kingdom is ruling via coercion, power, and deluding without any spiritual compassion and belief-related bonds. The two are binary opposites. Imamate is a movement among the ummah, for the ummah and in favor of rightfulness. A kingdom is an authoritarian dominance against the interest of the people, only serving particular classes of society, to fulfill ruling groups, hoarding the wealth and pleasing lust. What we see at the time of Imam Hussein's uprising is the second case, not the first one. That is, Yazid, who was in power then, had no relation with the people. He had no knowledge, no piety, no chastity, no experience of jihad for the cause of God, and no belief in Islam's spirituality. His behavior was not the behavior of a believer in Islam. His words were not the words of a wise man. He was in no way similar to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. In this situation, an opportunity arose for a person like Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the man who was apt for succeeding the Prophet, and he rose up.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا تشان أنا لا
Looking at the surface of the event, this uprising was against the corrupt and unpopular regime of Yazid. However, beneath the surface, it is an uprising for the sake of Islamic values, understanding, faith, and dignity. It is for the people to be set free from corruption, subordination, lowliness, and ignorance. It was for this reason that when Imam Hussein left Medina in a message to his brother, and in reality a message to the history, he wrote, "I am not rising out of selfishness or lust for power, nor to cause mayhem or pain. I'll rise looking for the correction in my grandfather's ummah. I see that things have changed in the society that the Prophet left. It is going toward the wrong direction, towards the corruption. It is against the direction coveted by Islam and the Prophet had preached. I rise to fight against these vices."
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.